Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we transform a stack of fascinating information into clear, actionable insights just for you.
And today, we are really plunging into the world of beekeeping. It's this amazing mix of science, nature, and honestly, quite a bit of joy.
It really is. We've got a great set of sources today, everything from equipment lists, annual calendars,
reports on urban beekeeping, and even a pretty lively debate around natural methods versus the more conventional ways.
So our mission today is to cut through some of that noise, give you the essential knowledge, maybe bust a few myths.
Yeah, and just highlight what becoming a beekeeper actually involves, the surprising bits too.
Exactly. Whether you're just a bit curious or maybe you're seriously thinking about getting your own hive, we want to get you informed. Okay, let's dive in.
Let's get buzzing.
All right, so first things first, if you're starting out, there's one hive design that keeps coming up, the Langstroth. Why is that one so recommended for beginners?
Well, the Langstroth is kind of the industry standard, you know? It's what most hobbyists and commercial guys use. And the big thing is, almost all the books, the guides, the resources you'll find, they're based on the Langstroth.
Ah, that makes sense. So learning is easier.
Exactly. Now, you will find people online who are really passionate about top bar hives or war hives.
Right, they're alternatives.
Definitely. But for someone brand new, the Langstroth is generally seen as much easier to handle, to inspect, just to get the hang of things.
Okay, that adaptability sounds key.
Yeah.
So let's break it down. What are the pieces of a Langstroth, starting from the bottom?
Sure. So right at the base, you've got the hive stand. Its main job is just lifting the whole hive up off the ground.
Why is that important?
Air circulation, mostly. Mm-hmm. And keeping it away from dampness. And here's a good tip from our sources. You don't really need to buy those fancy wooden ones from the catalogs.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they tend to rot anyway. Lots of beekeepers just use pressure-treated wood, concrete blocks, bricks, even old pallets. Works just as well, often lasts longer.
Good practical advice right off the bat. Okay, above the stand.
That's the bottom board. It's the floor of the hive, basically, where the bees come and go.
Are there different kinds?
There are. You hear about screened bottom boards, which can help you monitor for varroa mites.
Mites.
Yeah.
We definitely need to talk about those later.
We will. But for a beginner, starting with a simpler, solid bottom board is probably the way to go. Keep it straightforward initially.
Okay, simple is good. Then we get into the main boxes, right? The brood chambers.
Yeah.
Where the queen does her thing.
That's right. That's the nursery, where the eggs are laid, larvae develop, new bees emerge. A really common setup is two deep boxes.
Deep meaning big.
Yeah. They're the tallest ones, about 9-58 inches deep, usually holding 10 frames each.
Gotcha.
But there are options. You can get 8-frame equipment instead of 10-frame. The boxes are narrower, so they're lighter.
Lighter is definitely appealing.
It is, especially when they're full. Or another popular choice is using 3 medium boxes, sometimes called westerns, instead of 2 deeps for the brood chamber.
3 mediums instead of 2 deeps.
Yay. Again, weight. A full medium might be around 60 pounds, whereas a full deep can push 90 pounds. That's a big difference when you're lifting them.
Wow, yeah.
Plus, if you use mediums for your brood and your honey supers, then all your boxes are the same size. Standardizes everything. Makes life easier.
Ah, can see the appeal of that. Okay, so above the brood chambers, we have the honey supers. That's where the good stuff goes.
That's the idea. That's where the bees hopefully store excess honey that you can harvest. Most people use those medium boxes for supers too.
How many do you need?
Starting with 2 per hive is a pretty good average. You can use shallower boxes too. They're even lighter, but obviously hold less honey for the same amount of work assembling them.
Right, trade-offs. And what goes on the very top?
The cover or top.
Yeah.
2 main styles here. There's the telescoping top, which usually comes with an inner cover. It's a bit more elaborate.
And the other
is the migratory top. Just a simple, flat wooden lid. Often used by commercial guys because it's cheaper and stacks easily for moving hives.
You mentioned an inner cover with the telescoping top. Why is that needed?
Ah, super important. Bees love to seal everything up with propolis, that sticky plant resin. Without an inner cover, they'll glue that telescoping lid directly to the top super.
Making it hard to open.
Extremely hard. The inner cover provides a space and makes it manageable. Oh, and one more tip. Avoid those peaked garden-style roofs.
Why is that? They look kind of nice.
They do, but they're impractical. When you inspect a hive, you often need to take boxes off and set them somewhere. You can't lay a peaked roof flat on the ground to stack boxes on.
Huh. Didn't think of that. Okay, so that's the structure. What goes inside those boxes, the frames and foundation?
Exactly. The frames are the scaffolding that holds the honeycomb, and the type of frame depends on what kind of foundation you use inside it.
Foundation. That's like the starter sheet for the comb.
Pretty much. If you use traditional wax foundation, you need frames with a special wedge top bar to hold it. If you go with plastic foundation, you need a frame with a grooved top bar.
And the foundation itself. What are the choices?
You can get wax-coated plastic foundation, which is quite popular now, or wired wax foundation, or just plain unwired wax sheets.
Any recommendations?
Our sources do specifically warn against one brand called Duragilt. And if you want to produce cut comb honey, you need a special thin foundation for that.
Can you buy these frames already assembled?
Often, yes, if you're using plastic foundation. But wax foundation usually requires assembly. It's a bit more work, takes longer.
Right, the DIY aspect.
Mm-hmm.
If you choose wax, does it need extra support?
Yes, generally. Especially in honey supers, because extracting honey puts a lot of centrifugal force on the comb.
So how do you support it?
You usually embed wire into the wax. You stretch tinned wire across the frame, maybe four horizontal strands, and use a special tool to embed it right into the wax sheet.
Sounds fiddly.
It can be. You need tools like metal eyelets or grommets, a punch to make holes for them, spur embedders to press the wire in. A wiring jig helps hold the frame steady.
Okay. And assembling the actual wooden boxes, the hive bodies and supers, special nails or glue?
Good quality wood glue on all the joints is a must. For nails, galvanized ones are best. 7-penny box nails are often recommended, but they can be hard to find, so 6-penny will usually do. Some folks use screws or staples, too.
Okay. That covers the hive itself.
Mm.
What about protecting the beekeeper? Personal gear.
Right. PPE is crucial. A smoker is non-negotiable. A small 7-inch one with a heat shield is fine for hobbyists. Get a decent quality one. The cheap ones don't last.
What do you burn in it?
Lots of things work. Burlap scraps, dry pine needles, wood shavings. You need some newspaper as tinder to get it going, and matches, or a lighter, obviously.
And the essential hive tool.
Yep, that 10-inch metal bar, standard or hooked end. Indispensable for prying boxes and frames apart. Seriously, buy two. They vanish.
Happens to the best of us. What about veil and gloves?
A veil is an absolute must. Protects your face and neck. Can be built into a suit, worn with a helmet or a hatless style. Everyone working the hive needs one.
And gloves.
Gloves, too. Leather or sturdy rubber hands are best. Don't use cotton garden gloves. They lose all protection once they get sticky or wet. Some people even use rubber kitchen gloves in a pinch, temporarily.
Full bee suit. Optional.
Optional. Many just wear regular coveralls over their clothes, plus the veil and gloves. Depends on your comfort level.
Okay, and a really critical safety point our sources emphasize.
The EpiPen, yes. This is huge. It's prescription only, so you must talk to your doctor about getting one, maybe even two, before you start beekeeping, just in case of a severe allergic reaction.
Crucial advice. Any other useful bits and bobs?
A notebook and pen for keeping records. You learn so much faster that way. A bee brush is handy for gently moving bees off frames, but honestly, a leafy twig or a big feather works too.
Makes sense.
A frame lifter tool can be helpful, especially if you wear thick gloves. And a container, like a 5-gallon bucket with a lid, is great for carrying your smoker and tools, especially in the car, keeps the smoky smell contained.
Good tip.
Oh, and maybe a spray bottle with water for cleanup, some rubbing alcohol for dissolving propolis on tools, rags, and a lumber crayon for marking notes directly on the hive boxes.
Now, one thing the sources say not to buy right away is honey extracting equipment.
Yeah, definitely hold off on that. Extractors are expensive, and you likely won't get a huge honey harvest your first year, maybe not even the second.
So what do you do?
Wait, gain experience, talk to other beekeepers. Your local bee club might have an extractor you can borrow or rent, or you might go in with another beekeeper. Don't rush that purchase.
Smart. Okay, equipment sorted. Now, the exciting part, getting your bees. How does that work?
Two main ways. You can buy a package of bees, which is basically a screened box containing about 3 pounds of bees and a caged queen.
Ooh.
Or you can buy a nucleus hive, usually called a nuke. That's like a mini colony already established on, say, 4 or 5 frames, mm-hmm. complete with bees, brood, honey, and a laying queen.
Which is better for beginners.
Nucs generally establish faster because they're already a functioning unit. But packages are often easier to install. Your local bee club is the best place to find suppliers for either.
Important note, though, if you're using medium boxes for your brood chamber or a different hive type, like a top bar hive.
Right. Then you probably can't use a standard nuc because those usually come on deep frames. In that case, you'd need to start with a package.
Good point. What about different bee races? Italian, Carniolan? Does it matter much at the start?
Honestly, for a beginner, not really. Italian and Carniolan are the most common and are both generally good choices. Don't get bogged down in specific traits like Varroa-sensitive hygiene VSH right at the start.
Just focus on learning.
Exactly. Focus on learning how to manage the bees you have. Get comfortable with inspections. Understand their cycle. That's way more important initially than specific genetics.
Makes sense. Lastly, before someone jumps in, what about the time commitment and hive location?
It is a commitment, especially in spring and summer. You need to plan on inspecting each hive roughly every 7 to 10 days during the active season. That might take 20, 30 minutes per hive once you get efficient.
And less often other times.
Much less often in autumn and very rarely in winter, usually just quick checks from the outside. But also factor in the time for ordering assembling gear. It adds up. Plan ahead.
And where should you actually put the hive?
Ideally, somewhere it gets early morning sun. Facing southeast is often recommended. This gets them out foraging earlier.
Any space requirements?
Give them a clear flight path in front of the entrance, maybe 10, 15 feet clear. And try to keep hives at least 25 feet from property lines just to be neighborly.
Wow.
Having a water source within about 100 feet is also really beneficial for them.
What about local rules, like in the UK?
Generally, keeping bees in gardens is fine in the UK, but it's always smart to check with your local council and the local beekeeping association branch. They'll know any specific regulations.
So a lot to learn. Best resources.
Reading books and articles is vital, but honestly, the gold standard is joining your local beekeepers association. The advice, the classes, the workshops, the mentoring, it's invaluable. Truly indispensable for a hobbyist.
Okay, fantastic groundwork. We've got the gear. The bees are ordered. Now let's shift to the rhythm of the hive itself, the beekeeping year. What are some benefits people might not immediately think of?
Well, sure, there's the honey, but it's so much more. It's this incredible connection to the natural world, you know, watching the colony grow, understanding their cycles. It's deeply rewarding, almost therapeutic for some people.
And environmentally.
Huge benefits. Honeybees are amazing pollinators. Having managed hives locally is, as one source put it, terrific for boosting pollination in nearby gardens and wild areas. It supports biodiversity.
It's not just honey they produce, though, is it?
Not at all. There's beeswax, of course, historically vital for candles, waterproofing, still used loads in cosmetics, polishes. Then there's royal jelly, the special food for larvae destined to be queens. And propolis, that sticky resin they use as a sealant, it has antiseptic properties.
Wow. And can it be a source of income?
It can, yeah. Selling honey, beeswax products, maybe even Nux eventually. It can definitely grow beyond just a hobby for some.
It's fascinating how the colony changes throughout the year. It's not static at all.
Absolutely not. It's a constant state of flux, this intricate dance driven by the seasons. Take winter, the colony shrinks dramatically, maybe down to 10,000 bees or so.
What do they do? Just huddle?
Pretty much. They form a tight cluster around the queen. And they vibrate their wing muscles, not flying, just vibrating to generate heat. They can keep the center of that cluster around 90 degrees Fahrenheit.
Incredible. Just to stay warm.
To stay warm, yes, but also to keep their stored honey from crystallizing solid. And importantly, to allow the queen to lay eggs, even in winter, to start replacing older bees.
But winter's still dangerous for them.
Oh, definitely. That heat they generate creates moisture, condensation. If that cold water drips back onto the cluster, it can be lethal. And they burn through a lot of honey stores, maybe 24 pounds a month in the coldest part.
How do they survive with such low numbers?
Well, the bees that emerge in late fall are biologically different. They live much longer, maybe up to 5 months, specifically adapted to get the colony through winter. It's amazing. Some commercial guys even have special wintering buildings or truck their bees south.
Then comes spring, the Great Awakening.
Exactly. About 6 weeks before the first major pollen sources, like dandelions, the survivors kick into gear. As soon as it warms up to maybe 40, 50 degrees F and flowers start appearing, the beekeeper needs to be ready too.
Doing what?
Early inspections. Checking for disease, checking for those varroa mites, making sure the queen is laying well. She starts ramping up egg production dramatically. The population swells, maybe hitting 20,000.
Sounds like timing is everything.
It really is. No. Beekeepers get very tuned into phenology, the timing of natural events, like when certain flowers bloom. They know it takes roughly 45 days from egg to a foraging adult bee, so they manage the colony to build up strength for the main nectar flows.
And summer must be peak season. Maximum activity.
Absolute peak. The hive can explode in population, reaching 60,000, even 80,000 bees.
Wow. All focused on collecting nectar.
Mostly workers, yeah, collecting nectar, pollen, water, propolis. But the queen might also be producing drones, the males, and maybe even new queens if the colony gets crowded.
Which leads to swarming.
Potentially, yes. Swarming is the colony's natural way of reproducing, splitting in two. The old queen leaves with about half the bees to find a new home. It's something beekeepers usually try to manage or prevent so they don't lose half their workforce or have swarms settling in awkward places.
Then, as the season winds down into autumn,
things slow down, less nectar coming in, the queen reduces egg laying, the population starts to drop, maybe back to around 40,000. For the beekeeper, this is harvest time.
Taking the honey.
Taking the surplus honey. This is critical. You must leave enough for the bees to survive winter. That usually means leaving 50 to 100 pounds, depending on your climate and setup. Maybe 18 kilos or 15 if you're using a hive wrap like a bee cozy.
What else happens in autumn?
You might combine weak colonies with stronger ones, provided they're disease-free, to give them a better chance of making it through winter. Basically, buttoning everything up.
That's a great overview. Let's try to translate that into a rough month-by-month guide for the beekeeper, starting with the depths of winter.
Okay, January and February, mostly hands-off. You might heft the hive, gently lift one side, to guess if they have enough food stores. Don't open them up unless absolutely necessary.
So what do you do?
Read. Study. Build or repair equipment. Order your bees and gear for the season. Towards the end of Feb, maybe do a Varroa count using the bottom board insert and start planning your mite strategy.
Then March, signs of life.
Hopefully. You'll see bees bringing in pollen on their legs, yellow, orange, depending on the source. It's a great sight. But March can be tricky. Hives can starve now if they ran low over winter, so keep hefting and feed if they feel light.
The
sugar syrup, or maybe fondant candy. When it warms up reliably, you can remove winter protection like mouse guards or woodpecker netting and start a new hive record card for the season, essential for tracking.
April. Things really pick up now.
Definitely. Spring feeding might continue if needed. Time for spring cleaning, maybe swapping out the old bottom board and brood box for clean ones. And crucially, start your regular inspections, maybe every 7 to 9 days, once temps are consistently above 15 Celsius, about 60°F.
What are you looking for in those inspections?
Queen health is she laying? Good brood pattern, enough food stores, signs of disease, and importantly, signs of swarm preparation, like queen cells. This is also when you might start Varroa management, like removing drone brood.
When do you add the first honey supers?
Once the bees are covering, say, 7 or 8 frames out of 10 in the top brood box, give them space before they feel crowded. That helps prevent swarming.
So May is peak swarm season management.
Often, yes. Keep up those regular inspections. You might set up bait hives or swarm traps nearby. Keep adding supers ahead of their needs. Giving them foundation to draw out into comb keeps young bees busy and can reduce the swarm urge.
Okay, into June. More of the same.
Pretty much. Continue inspections. This might be a good time to make a nucleus colony, maybe with an older queen you want to replace, or if you just want another hive. Or if a colony is showing signs of being overly defensive, you might requeen it.
What about those Asian hornet traps some people mention?
Ooh, yeah, the thinking on that is evolving. While some guides mention them, many beekeepers now feel it's better not to trap indiscriminately. Wasps and hornets have their own roles, and sometimes their presence points to a weakness in your hive you need to address.
Interesting shift. Okay, high summer, July.
Keep inspecting. Watch out for robbing bees from other hives trying to steal honey, especially if there's a nectar dearth. Late July, early August is often the time for the main honey harvest.
Removing the supers.
Removing the full supers, yeah. After extracting the honey, you put the wet, sticky supers back on the hive for a day or two. The bees will clean them bone dry. Then you take them off for storage. This gives the bees time to focus on storing nectar in their brood box for winter.
Any mite treatment around now?
If your mite counts are getting high, yes. Products like Apigard often need warmer temperatures, like above 15°C for several weeks, so this time frame can work well.
August. Shifting towards winter prep.
Definitely. Add an entrance reducer, a small block of wood narrowing the hive entrance. This makes it easier for the bees to defend against robbing wasps or other bees. Start feeding sugar syrup if their stores look low.
September.
Yeah.
Really focusing on winter stores now.
Absolutely. Check colony strength. Do they have bees covering at least 5 frames? If not, and they're healthy, consider uniting them with a stronger colony. Check food stores. Are they getting close to that target weight? 18 kilograms or 15 kilograms with a cozy
AD thick syrup.
Yes. A 2-to-1 mix of sugar to water by weight is typical for autumn feeding. Remember, 1 kilogram of sugar makes about 1.25 kilograms of stores. Use a queen excluder under the feeder to stop the queen drowning. Don't overfeed, though. Once they hit target weight, stop!
What else in September?
Clean all the equipment you've taken off supers, queen excluders, store them carefully, protected from wax moths and mice. Freezing frames kills wax moth eggs.
October, final winter prep.
Pretty much. Finish feeding if needed. Remove queen excluders from the hive entirely. Configure the hive for winter ventilation. This is critical.
Ventilation? I thought you wanted to keep them warm.
You do, but moisture is the real killer. Their respiration creates water vapor. You need enough ventilation, often at the top for solid floors, or just rely on the mesh floor if using one, so moist air can escape, preventing condensation dripping on the bees. An insulated roof helps retain heat but allow moisture out.
Any other October tasks?
Pilt the hive slightly forward so any condensation runs down the wall, not onto the bees. Add mouse guards by the end of the month, once the bees start clustering and can't defend the whole entrance. Maybe add chicken wire around the hive if woodpeckers are a problem in your area.
And the last couple of months, November and December. Very quiet.
Mostly. November. Do a final Vera account. Make sure hives are secure against wind and rain. December. Keep entrances clear of dead bees. Maybe shift the entrance block up slightly. The optimal time for oxalic acid mite treatment in the UK is usually mid to late December, when the colony is broodless.
Can you still feed them?
Only if absolutely necessary, and use solid fondant candy, not syrup, placed directly over the cluster. Check your stored equipment again for pests.
That's like a comprehensive year. Okay, let's talk about the honey harvest, the sweet reward. When exactly can you harvest?
Typically late summer or early autumn, but the key is only harvest frames where the bees have capped the honey cells with wax. That means the honey is ripe and won't ferment.
And you mentioned leaving enough for the bees?
Absolutely paramount. Never take it all. They need substantial stores to survive winter. Estimate conservatively how much they need based on your climate.
What gear do you need specifically for harvesting?
Your bee suit, veil, gloves. Smoker and hive tool. Then an uncapping tool, a special fork or heated knife to remove the wax cappings. A honey extractor is needed to spin the honey out.
The thing you said not to buy right away.
Exactly. Borrow, rent, or share one initially. Then you need food grade buckets, filters, or strainers to remove wax bits, jars for bottling, and labels.
Walk us through the process briefly.
Safety gear on first. Calm the bees with a little smoke. Gently remove the frames of capped honey from the supers. Take them somewhere clean and bee-proof. Uncap the cells using your fork or knife. Place the frames in the extractor and spin out the honey. Filter the honey into buckets. Let it settle for a bit, then bottle and label. Simple, but sticky.
I bet. Beyond honey, you mentioned beeswax. How do bees actually make it?
It's amazing. Worker bees have special glands on their abdomens that secrete tiny flakes of wax. They chew these flakes, mixing them with saliva to make them pliable, and then sculpt them into the perfect hexagonal cells of the honeycomb.
And its uses. Still relevant today.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Candles, obviously. But it's widely used in cosmetics. Lip balms, lotions, creams, used for waterproofing fabrics, as a furniture polish, even coating candies sometimes. Very versatile natural product.
How does a beekeeper process it? Say, from those wax cappings after harvest.
It's pretty straightforward. You melt the cappings, usually in a double boiler or a dedicated slow cooker to avoid scorching. Then you strain the melted wax through fine mesh or cheesecloth to filter out honey residue and other bits. Pour the clean wax into molds, let it cool and harden, and voila, blocks of beeswax. Store it in a cool, dry place.
Beekeeping sounds incredibly rewarding. But we know it's not without challenges. And the big one, the one everyone talked about, is the Varroa mite.
Ugh. Yes. Varroa destructor. It's hard to overstate the impact these mites have had since they arrived in the U.S. in the 80s and spread globally. They are, arguably, the single biggest headache for beekeepers everywhere.
What do they actually do to the bees?
They're parasites. They feed on the bees' fat bodies. Think of it like their liver weakening both adult bees and the developing brood. This leads to smaller, weaker bees with shorter lifespans, physical deformities.
Nasty.
And maybe even worse, they transmit a whole host of viruses. Things like deformed wing virus, K-wing. You might see bees crawling on the ground, unable to fly. A spotty, unhealthy-looking brood pattern is often another sign of a heavy Varroa infestation.
So how on earth do you manage them? It sounds relentless.
It is relentless. The best approach is called Integrated Pest Management, IPM. It's not about eliminating every single mite, which is impossible, but keeping the population below a threshold where they cause serious economic or health damage to the colony.
What's that threshold, roughly?
Ideally, you want fewer than about 1,000 mites in a full-sized colony, maybe proportionally less in a smaller one. It requires a combination of methods, not just relying on one thing.
And the first step is knowing how many mites you actually have.
Monitoring is absolutely critical. You can't manage what you don't measure. Beekeepers need to check mite levels several times a year, early spring, after the main spring honey flow, again when harvesting honey, and in late autumn.
How do you monitor?
Several ways. You can use a sticky board under a screened bottom board to count mites that fall naturally over, say, 24 or 72 hours. You can uncap drone brood mites, prefer drone cells, and count mites there, or do a sugar roll or alcohol wash on a sample of bees.
A sugar roll?
Yeah, you scoop about half a cup of bees, roughly 300, into a jar with powdered sugar, gently roll them to dislodge the mites, then shake the mites out onto a white surface to count. If you get more than about, say, 9 mites from 300 bees, that's a 3% infestation, it's generally time to treat. Thresholds vary, but that's a common guide.
Okay, so you monitor, find you have too many mites. What are the treatment options?
This is where it gets complex. Some older chemical treatments, synthetic pyrethroids like Apistan or Bavarol, while the mites have developed widespread resistance to them in many areas, they just don't work reliably anymore.
So what does work?
There are softer organic acid treatments like formic acid, oxalic acid, or thymol-based products like Apigard. There are also other synthetic miticides with different modes of action, and biotechnical methods like removing drone brood or creating brood breaks can help.
Like the oxalic acid treatment in winter you mentioned.
Exactly. Oxalic acid vaporization or dribble is very effective when the colony has little or no sealed brood, which is typically in late December in the UK. That's often a key part of an IPM strategy. But you need multiple approaches throughout the year.
Might sound like a huge issue. Are there other major threats to bee health?
Oh, yes. Diseases are a constant concern. American foul brood, AFB, is a really nasty bacterial disease. It's highly contagious. Spores last for decades. If found, it's usually legally required to report it, and the hive and equipment must be destroyed, often by burning.
Wow, drastic.
It has to be, to prevent spreading. There's also European foul brood, EFB, chalk brood, Nosema, a whole list. Good hygiene and strong colonies are the best defense. Some beekeepers use antibiotics preventatively against AFB, but that's controversial and regulated differently in different places.
And it's not just pests and diseases causing problems for bees globally, right?
Correct. The broader issue of colony decline is complex. Pesticide exposure, both agricultural and garden use, is a major factor. Herbicides reducing forage diversity. Lack of consistent, knowledgeable management by beekeepers themselves, predators like badgers or woodpeckers in some areas, and climate change impacts, like drought affecting nectar availability.
You mentioned feeding earlier. That plays a role in colony health, too.
Definitely. Providing supplementary feed sugar syrup, pollen patties during shortages or droughts can be crucial for building colony strength and helping them fight off diseases. Practices vary regionally, though. And interestingly, one source noted that globally, women often handle a large share of the feeding tasks.
We touched on the pest management debate regarding wasps and hornets. It sounds like thinking is shifting towards a more ecological view.
It seems to be, yes. Rather than just killing any perceived pest, there's more awareness that these creatures have roles. Wasps near a hive might actually signal it's weak and needs help. Hornets prey on other insects. It's moving away from automatic eradication towards understanding the bigger picture.
This leads us nicely into maybe the most contentious area. The whole natural beekeeping versus conventional approach. This seems to spark real debate.
It really does. It gets down to fundamental philosophies about our relationship with bees and nature. Some argue the very act of keeping bees, putting them in boxes we designed, is inherently unnatural.
So what would truly natural be, in their view?
One source puts it starkly. Set out empty hive cavities, let bees move in if they choose, observe them, but don't interfere at all. Let them live or die based entirely on natural pressures.
But the natural beekeeping movement isn't usually that extreme, is it? It's more about emulating wild conditions, often framed as saving the bees.
Generally, yes. Trying to align practices more closely with how bees might live without human management. But, as another source counters quite forcefully, nature is not benevolent. With ruthless indifference, she makes all things serve their purposes. Nature involves a lot of death and failure.
So how do these approaches stack up when we look at animal welfare, using those five freedoms? Let's start with freedom from hunger and thirst.
Okay. Natural beekeepers often strongly oppose feeding sugar syrup or pollen supplements. The philosophy is that bees should forage for themselves, find their own resources. Survival of the fittest, essentially.
And the conventional view
is that intervention is sometimes necessary and humane. Providing supplementary feed can prevent starvation during nectar dearths or harsh winters when, as the source says, even nature gets it wrong. It's about ensuring survival, but it does require careful judgment about how much honey to leave versus how much to feed.
Okay, what about freedom from discomfort? The hive environment itself.
Some natural beekeeping proponents claim standard Langstroth hives contribute to losses. The counterargument is that this is nonsense, as honeybees are incredibly adaptable cavity dwellers. Interestingly, wild bees do often choose smaller cavities than standard hives provide.
So natural beekeepers might use smaller hives?
Sometimes, yes. But they know this makes the colony more likely to swarm, which has its own consequences for survival, both for the swarm and the parent colony.
Now the big one, freedom from pain, injury, and disease. This is where varroa really comes into it, right?
Absolutely. This is probably the sharpest point of division. Many natural beekeepers advocate for treatment-free beekeeping. They believe in letting natural selection work colonies susceptible to varroa and the viruses they carry will die out.
The idea being that survivors will have genetic resistance.
That's the hope, that over time, this selects for bees that can cope with mites. However, the genetics are complex. Queen bees mate with many drones from different colonies, so desired traits can be easily diluted unless you have geographically isolated populations.
And the conventional approach.
Use it like veterinary or human medicine. If there's a known disease or parasite causing suffering and death, the ethical choice is to prevent or treat it. They argue that allowing a colony to succumb slowly and horribly to varroa and viruses is neglectful, stating there's, quote, no excuse for allowing a colony to suffer an ugly death.
A very stark difference in perspective. How about freedom to express normal behavior, like swarming?
Natural beekeepers often see swarming as essential. It's the bee's natural reproduction and the break in the brood cycle when the swarm leaves can temporarily reduce mite levels.
But does it work long term for mite control?
Evidence suggests not sufficiently on its own. One study found virus levels were actually higher in feral colonies compared to managed ones, despite frequent swarming. And the survival rate of swarms in the wild is very low. Maybe 25% make it through the first year. Plus, the original hive survival depends on the new queen mating successfully. It's risky results in a lot of dead bees.
So conventional beekeepers try to prevent swarming.
Or manage it. They might prevent uncontrolled swarming or simulate it by splitting a strong colony, which achieves a similar brood break, but with much higher survival rates and less loss of bees.
And the final freedom. Freedom from fear and distress.
Natural beekeeping often emphasizes minimal intervention, minimal hive inspections, believing this reduces stress.
Sounds reasonable.
On the surface. But critics argue if minimal intervention means no monitoring for disease, no checking food stores, allowing uncontrolled swarming and starvation, then it crosses the line into neglect. Conventional beekeepers see regular, careful inspections as the heart and soul of beekeeping, essential for learning, for spotting problems early, and for ensuring the colony's well-being. They accept a small amount of disturbance as the price for responsible care.
It really highlights that saying, ask 10 beekeepers, get 15 opinions. There's no single right way, it seems.
Exactly. It's a continuous learning process. And why, as one source advises, beekeepers should try to get away from using words like always and never. You have to adapt.
Okay, shifting gears dramatically now, let's look at urban beekeeping. It feels counterintuitive, bees in the middle of a city, but it's booming.
It really is. And the perception of cities as ecological deserts is often wrong, at least for pollinators. Research shows cities can be surprisingly vibrant. Think parks, gardens, window boxes, street trees, green roofs. They offer a diverse and often continuous supply of forage.
More diverse than some rural areas, even.
Potentially, yeah, compared to large agricultural monocultures. Studies have found urban bees can have higher winter survival rates and produce significantly more honey. 56% more in one study than suburban bees, and they pollinate a wider variety of plants. It's quite an eye-opener.
And this isn't brand new, is it?
Not entirely. Humans have harvested honey for millennia. Bees were brought to North America centuries ago. But modern urban beekeeping really got a boost in Paris in the 1980s and spread from there.
Was it always legal on cities?
No. Initially, many U.S. cities had ordinances against farm animals, which included bees. It took activism and advocacy to change those laws. New York City legalized it in 2010. Boston 2013, LA 2015. It's often linked now with movements around sustainable building and urban agriculture.
So what are the driving benefits making it so popular in cities?
Several key things. One, bees act as indicator species. Their health and what they collect provides valuable data on urban environmental quality and pollinator health.
Like tiny environmental monitors.
Exactly. Two, they pollinate urban agriculture, rooftop farms, community gardens, backyard plots. Bees boost yields for over 85 different crops, contributing to local food security. Some even claim local honey helps with allergies, though the science on that is debated.
What else?
They help connect people to nature in dense urban settings. A visible hive is a powerful symbol. Fourth, for buildings, hives can contribute towards sustainability certifications like LED scores. And fifth, it engages the community. It's a unique amenity for office tenants or residents, boosts the company's green image, and provides educational opportunities.
Makes sense. But surely there are unique urban challenges. Space must be one.
Definitely. Hive placement is key. Ground level space is scarce, so rooftops are seen as this biggest underutilized asset. Putting hives on a roof is a relatively easy, low-cost way to start roof greening.
What about people getting stung? Proximity is much closer in a city.
That's the human interaction challenge. Sites need careful selection to minimize unwanted encounters. But remember, honeybees are bred for gentleness. And ironically, swarming bees, which look scary, are actually at their least defensive because they're focused on finding a new home and have no brood or stores to protect.
And the issue of enough food and habitat for all pollinators in the city.
Pollinator habitat loss is a real issue in dense, growing cities. The solution isn't fewer honeybees, but more habitat planting diverse native flowering plants on balconies and parks, and especially on those rooftops. Creating rich foraging and nesting opportunities benefits honeybees and native pollinators.
Speaking of native pollinators, that's a common misconception, isn't it? That honeybees harm native bees in cities.
It's a valid concern because honeybees live in huge colonies and can potentially outcompete solitary native bees if resources are scarce. But again, the answer is habitat enhancement. Make the city a richer place for all pollinators. Cities can actually become refuges for pollinators displaced from less diverse rural or suburban landscapes.
Another misconception. Are hives near public spaces dangerous?
Mostly, no. It's about perception versus reality. Bees are focused on foraging. People are far more likely to encounter them peacefully on flowers than be bothered by a well-managed hive sighted thoughtfully. The risk is often blown out of proportion.
And the honey itself. Is urban honey safe with potential pollution?
This question comes up a lot, but extensive testing consistently shows urban honey is perfectly safe. It meets all regulatory standards for human consumption. Bees are amazing filters themselves.
So if someone's interested in urban beekeeping, what's the takeaway on laws and best practices?
Check your local city ordinances first. Rules vary widely on hive numbers, placement, registration, maybe even notifying neighbors. Joining a local beekeeping association is crucial here too. There's no single right way for urban beekeeping. You have to adapt to your specific environment.
Fascinating. To round out our global view, let's touch on beekeeping in Ethiopia, Africa's top honey producer, top 10 globally, yet mostly traditional methods.
It's a really interesting contrast. Ethiopia has this incredibly long tradition, 5,000 years. Traditional hives are made from whatever's local: logs, clay, straw, bamboo. You have forest beekeeping with hives high in trees, often risky, mostly done by men.
An alternative.
Backyard beekeeping, hives near homes, much safer. Women can participate more easily, provides direct family income.
But these traditional hives have limitations.
Big ones. Lower productivity. Harvesting often destroys the comb and colony because there are no movable frames. You can't inspect inside properly, can't manage swarming, can't easily feed them.
Are there any upsides to traditional hives?
From the beekeeper's perspective, yes. Very low startup cost, require less technical skill and management effort. And they actually tend to produce more beeswax and propolis, which in Ethiopia can sometimes fetch higher prices than the honey itself.
Has there been a push towards modern hives like Langstroth's?
Yes. Transitional hives like the Kenyan top bar hive and modern frame hives, Langstroth, Zander, Dedant, have been introduced to try and boost honey production and make management easier.
But adoption is low. Why?
Multiple barriers. High costs and lack of availability of the equipment, not just hives, but extractors, wax foundation molds, smokers, veils. Lack of adequate training and ongoing support for beekeepers. And they face the same pressures we see elsewhere: pesticides, habitat loss, drought, pests, diseases impacting colony numbers.
Any specific management differences that stand out?
Ethiopian beekeepers often work their hives after sunset, traditionally to reduce stinging incidents with the local bees, which can be more defensive. Internal inspections are much less common, especially with traditional hives. Replacing old comb is also a major challenge due to cost and availability of new foundation wax.
So reflecting on this Ethiopian example, how does understanding these global variations help us think about beekeeping debates here, say in the UK or US cities?
It really underscores that beekeeping isn't one single thing. The biology of the bee might be universal, but the context, the climate, the culture, the available resources, the economic pressures, the local bee genetics, it all shapes how people interact with bees. It reminds us there are many ways to keep bees, many challenges, and maybe lessons we can learn from different traditions, even as technology evolves. It adds important perspective to our own debates.
Okay, we have covered a huge amount of ground. So what does all this mean for you, whether you're thinking of starting bees or just curious about them?
Well, we've taken a really deep dive today, haven't we? From the nuts and bolts of the hive itself, through the whole yearly cycle of the colony.
The ongoing battle with viral mites, those really fundamental debates about natural versus intervention.
And the surprising boom in urban beekeeping, plus that global perspective from Ethiopia.
It's so clear that beekeeping is this journey of constant learning. There are so many opinions, so many nuances, always something new to discover.
It really connects you to the natural world in a very direct way. And it definitely makes you think hard about things like animal welfare and environmental impact.
When you look at the bigger picture, it's about so much more than just honey, isn't it? It's about careful observation, about stewardship.
About having this ongoing dialogue with these incredible, vital creatures.
So what stands out most to you from everything we've discussed today? And here's something to ponder. Given all the challenges, all the different philosophies and approaches we've explored, what do you think is the single most important quality a beekeeper needs to develop for long-term success and genuinely healthy hives?